This is Bishara Dumani coming at you from the Watson Institute for International Studies to talk with Professor Yasser Munif about the situation in Syria today. 2 years ago, in March 2011, anti-government graffiti by young boys in the provincial town of Daraa sparked an uprising, followed by a brutal government crackdown and then an armed conflict that has spiraled out of control. Now, approaching the second year anniversary, we realize that the consequences are truly horrific. According to UN government sources, there are close to 70,000 Syrians that have been killed. The number of refugees is very high. There are no accurate numbers, but they range anywhere from 700,000 to 1.5 million, plus 2 to 3 million internally displaced. This seems to be a conflict without an end in sight, a conflict that has no winners, only losers. What is going on in Syria? What are the myths and realities of the Syrian situation? Is it a war or a revolution? Here to talk to me about the causes, developments, and current situation and possible future trajectories of the conflict in Syria is Professor Yasser Munif of Emerson University, a sociologist, a scholar, an activist from Syria. He teaches courses on nationalism, political economy, and urban studies at Emerson. Professor Munif was raised in Syria and has traveled there often in the past year. This conflict in Syria reminds me of the Iran-Iraq War of 1980 to 1988, an interminable war seemingly without end at a very strategic piece of real estate in the world, like Syria seems to be as well. Neither side is favored by world powers. Stalemate, the United States and Russia divided, and the basic suffering is reserved for everyday people. Would you describe this conflict in these terms? Is this a war or is it a continuing revolution?
I think it's a continuation of the Arab Revolution with very challenging situation for Syrians and for the opposition. One of the problems right now with the Syrian revolution is that it comes after the Tunisian, Libyan, and Egyptian revolutions. The regime, in a way, had some time to prepare the counter-revolution and undermine any form of civil and peaceful resistance and struggle. In addition, the regime in Syria is quite different from other regimes in the region. It's much more cohesive. It's much more homogeneous. And it has a long history of dismantling and crushing the different factions of the opposition. So the situation in Syria is in many ways a continuation of the Arab Revolution with very specific and different conditions and factors.
So tell me about the players. Who are the players in the Syrian revolution right now? Map out the political situation for us, if you can.
So locally, there is the regime and there is the opposition. There are the different faction or dimension of the regime. The regime is basically based on a security apparatus, a very powerful and quite massive security apparatus. There is also the military, which is still solid. There are defections, and some generals and high-ranking officials have defected, but it's still maintaining its cohesion. There are the Shabiha, a type of militia thugs, and that's a quite sizable faction. The numbers varies between 10,000 to 20,000 thugs, Shabiha, and they're well-equipped and armed. In addition to that, there is the civilian class, which is quite sizable. Around 1.5 to 2 million people work in the public sector. And they're not necessarily all loyal to the regime, but they're dependent on the regime. There is, in addition to that, the middle class and upper class, new bourgeoisie, which is organically attached to the regime since the neoliberal turn in the early 2000s. And this class is based in Aleppo and Damascus. And this is why we see those cities still reluctant to embrace the revolution and the rebels. In addition to that, there is the different sects. And the sects are, so far, have been reluctant to join the revolution. That doesn't necessarily mean that they support the regime, but for the most part, they are very critical of the revolution.
And what about the opposition?
The opposition is also multi-layered. There are many dimensions to the opposition. There is the civilian dimension to the opposition, and that was the dominant dimensions until 10 months into the revolution. No one controls the demonstrations and the protest and the different forms of activism on the ground. But the local coordination committees, which are neighborhood and village-based information activists, groups, are very close to the demonstrations. They don't organize the demonstrations, but they are a kind of middleman between the demonstrators on the one hand and the established opposition. And so they became quite powerful during the first month of the revolution. Until July or August, they were really the...
Of 2011.
Of 2011. Mm-hmm. They were the dominant component of the revolution. Starting from July and August, and because of the violence of the regime and the harsh crushing of the peaceful demonstrations and so on, and the militarization of the revolution, we saw their role shrinking, and we saw the emergence of the Free Syrian Army, which is right now dominant in the revolution. So there is the local coordination committees, there is the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, and there is the established traditional opposition, mostly based in the they're exiled. Part of it is inside Syria. And there are two components to the established opposition. Some of it was made the coalition under the Syrian Council, the Syrian National Council. And the other part was unified under the National Coordination Committees. Their position to the West was quite different. The internal opposition was critical of the West, didn't want any kind of alliance with the West, with Europe or the United States, didn't want any foreign intervention, was opposed to the Gulf funding the revolution. And the SNC, the Syrian National Council, was, on the contrary, very close to the West, willing to get funding from the Gulf, and was trying to prepare the terrain for an intervention, which didn't come. And later on, this SNC morphed into the National Coalition. So this is more or less the topology of the opposition. And more recently, we have seen emerging as part of the military opposition the Salafist and the jihadi fighters, which are not part of the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, and they are becoming quite an important dimension of the military opposition. Right now, the Free Syrian Army has around 90,000 to 120,000 members. They're not necessarily very well equipped. They're not necessarily professional fighters. Oftentimes, they are recruited in neighborhoods. More and more, there are soldiers who are defectors from the army. And the FSA is quite heterogeneous. Some of it is secular, and we can even find Christian and Durzi and Alawi fighters and battalions as well. And some of it is more Salafi.
Explain Salafi, please.
Salafi is the fundamentalist, Islamist component of the opposition. And they part of it wants to establish an Islamic Syria post-conflict. And there are variations within the Salafi movement. Some of it has a global perspective, like Al-Qaeda, mm-hmm. and the representative of Al-Qaeda in Syria is Jabhat al-Nusra. And some of it is more regional or local. They don't have any connections with the global jihadi movement. Mm-hmm. All they want to do is establish al-Sharia in Syria and have an Islamic Syria in the future. So they're not all on the same page, and they don't necessarily all agree on the terms of how to create the new Syria or the Syria in the future. And so we see all these tensions and the global players and the regional players among all these different factions, especially in the military, because the regional players and the international players want to have a say in the future Syria. And the way they are doing that is by funding and defunding the different factions of the military opposition.
So we understand from the U.S. media that the United States has put a group on the ground on the Turkish border for the most part that is filtering what kind of aid and weapons get to what kind of groups. But Turkey is involved in this as well. And it's not just a competition between Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and individual Syrian funders. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a little bit about how Turkey is involved, how the United States is involved, and maybe other members of the European Union?
So initially what was interesting is that some of the Syrian were lured by the rhetoric about the friends of Syria mm-hmm. and about Iran and Russia being the main allies to the regime, and that the West in general and the Gulf and the Turkey were friends to Syria and were helping the revolution and giving weapons and so on. More recently, most Syrians are aware that they don't have any friends. They have only enemies.
So if we take a step back into history, mm-hmm. What you're describing seems to be exactly the situation that Patrick Seal talked about in The Struggle for Syria when he wrote that book almost a generation ago, about how Syria has been an object of competition between forces to the West and the South, Egypt through and the United States, Europe through Lebanon, and the Hashemite regime, and forces to its east from Iraq to Iran, etc., because it is such a strategically important part of the post-World War I state order in the Middle East that emerged after the demise of the Ottoman Empire. Are we reliving the past here, or how would you describe the historical context, the relevance of the historical context to what's happening in Syria today?
The post-independence history is quite tricky in the region. Syria has been playing, as you say, a very strategic role because of the creation of the State of Israel, because of the role that Egypt played during the 1950s and the 1960s, because of the emergence of an important nationalist movement in Syria and Iraq and other places. And some of it was promising. The nationalist and the communist and the left in general in Syria was quite dominant and important. But those movements were hijacked. They were hijacked by the elite, the political elite in Syria. And the post-independence history have been undermined by the dominance of that elite and the bourgeoisie in Syria.
So if we put it in U.S. public discourse terms, in the past, the struggle seemed to be between monarchists and royalists and pro-Western regimes, and on the one hand, and pan-Arab nationalist republican regimes on the other. One was led by Egypt, this is in the 50s and the 60s, and the other one was led from Iraq and Saudi Arabia. But now the vocabulary has shifted. Now it's represented as a struggle between Orthodox Sunni Islam on the one hand and Shiite or heterodox Islamic movement on the other, the Syrian regime being one that is dominated by the Alawi sect. So is this just simply a change in vocabulary to describe the same set of geostrategic factors, or is there something else going on here?
So there is a shift, obviously, and the nationalist and the left has been defeated in that region, in Iraq, in Egypt, and in Syria. And instead, we have seen emerging a very dogmatic, authoritarian type of nationalist regimes in Syria, in Iraq, and in other places. And the official narrative in Syria is that the regime is anti-imperial, it's nationalist, it's socialist, that it's defending the Palestinian cause, and so on and so forth. This is the facade. This is the rhetoric. In reality, the Syrian regime is playing, again, a very vicious role. And very early on, it was very much, for example, opposed to any popular struggle against Israel, and was able to seize power because of its very conservative position toward Palestine. They crushed the progressive parties. They were allied to the more right-wing Palestinian parties. They crushed the Palestinian resistance in Lebanon.
And Syria did intervene militarily in Lebanon in 1976 to prevent a victory of the so-called secular, nationalist, and progressive forces from who were fighting against right-wing forces in Lebanon during the Lebanese Civil War. Mm-hmm. So this anti-imperialist, official anti-imperialist stance seems to still confuse a lot of people today.
It is. The Syrian regime has supported Hamas and Hezbollah, has funded and shipped weapons to Hezbollah, backed Hezbollah in its war against Israel in 2006 and in other wars. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, oftentimes it was allied to the U.S. For example, in 1991, the father of the current president, Hafez Assad, participated in the Gulf War in against Iraq and sent troops to Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. Later on in 2001, after the 9/11 and the war on terror, the current president was willing to torture Syrians and provide information to the CIA and to the West in general. In addition to that, there is the whole neoliberal economic turn that the current president imposed on Syria since 2000, and the defunding of any welfare programs, social programs, the cut on corporate taxes, the lowering on import taxes, and so on, basically implementing a neoliberal program that really benefited the Alawite sect, take over of the business and the corporates and so on.
So for our listeners, can you just tell us for a moment, who are the Alawites in Syria? Why are they important in this particular regime?
The Alawites are a small Muslim sect, and they represent around 12% to 14% of the Syrian population. They are in high-ranking position in the military, the security, and in the business sector.
I should add here that the Alawites have not always been in this position.
They have been very marginalized and poor and discriminated against until the takeover of the power in 1960s.
And the way they achieved that takeover in 1960s was primarily because the Alawites were recruited into the officer corps by the French colonial power, which sought to use them as a bulwark against what they conceived of as the Sunni nationalist anti-colonial movements at the time. So back to inside of Syria. Can you tell us a little bit about the internally displaced? When somebody says there's 2 to 3 million Syrians who are internally displaced, that's a huge number considering the overall population of Syria. Can you give us a sense of who are these people, where are they moved from, where to where, and how are they making do in their daily life?
So what happened recently, at least since last year, is an important debate among the military opposition. Part of the opposition wanted to control the suburbs of the big cities, and that's mostly the position of Jabhat al-Nusra, the Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups, and their unwillingness to enter the cities to avoid the massive destruction and retaliation of the regime. The FSA, the Free Syrian Army, had a different position. They wanted and they believed that they couldn't defeat the regime without entering the city and having a guerrilla warfare inside the cities. That led to the massive destruction of many regions in Aleppo, in Hama, in Idlib, and other regions, and part of Homs, and so on. The strategy of the regime has been to punish the opposition by through that violence and through the displacement of the population. And what it wants to achieve is a reaction by the population. And it's also a signal to the population in Aleppo and Damascus, the two most important cities in Syria, that if the Free Syrian Army enters those cities, this is what you could expect. This is what is going to happen. That's why we see a large amount of the residents in Damascus and in Aleppo and other big cities, mostly the middle class and the upper class, unwillingness to embrace and support the revolution because of the high price they might pay. There are currently around 2 to 3 million internally displaced. In addition, as you mentioned, almost a million and million and a half refugees outside Syria. They are living very harsh conditions because of the winter. Some of them are dying in the camps. We had reports about kids and individuals dying in the Jordanian camps and the Turkish camps because of the winter and the cold weather. Oftentimes, they are starving. The regime has been bombarding bakeries, fuel stations, and so on, again, to punish the population and so on. So there is a substantial need for humanitarian intervention and the need for support of that that population.
So this raises a fundamental issue about the nature of revolutionary movements, political and social movements, new forms of social and political organization in the wake of the Arab revolutions, but also in the wake of the militarization of what began as a series of popular uprisings against long lasting regimes, most of them from the 70s until this period. The optimism of the Arab Spring, so to speak, has been replaced by the horror of protracted military conflict. You mentioned earlier the coordinating committees, which were committed from the very beginning to a nonviolent form of struggle. Can you give us a sense of, first, the possibility that nonviolent opposition to dictatorial regimes can actually lead to something now, considering how militarized the conflict has become? And two, if they are still playing an important role, how are they doing it in this context?
So Syria is playing really in a very important role in the region as part of the Arab Revolution, the Arab uprising. After the successful overthrow of the Tunisian, Egyptian, and Libyan dictators, Syria became the main hub for the counter-revolution, not only for the regime, but also for the regional and international players. And they perceive Syria as a way to undermine this momentum in the Arab region. At the same time, the potentials in Syria are really important. If we look at the present, the situation is really depressing. Mm. But if we look at the long term and the possibilities of that present in Syria, there are a lot of potentials. What we have seen emerging in Syria is a new form of organization. In the beginning of the revolution, we saw the formation of the local coordination committees, who are mostly university students and civilians and educated youth, plus others who were committed to supporting the revolution through civilian struggle, by providing information, by gathering funding, by helping refugees and so on. Later on, the LCC, the local coordination committees, have been marginalized because of the militarization of the conflict. More recently, what we have seen emerging are the local councils, which are not only providing information to the military and so on, but also are taking over wherever the state has been absent. So, for example, they're providing information to protect the population whenever there are attacks. They also try to get funding to get bread and fuel for the residents. They also have some type of participatory democracy. They have elected councils that are an interesting experience in local democracy that we have been seeing also in Egypt and other places that has the potential to evolve. Right now, it's dominated by tribal and quite traditional kind of political players, but it could evolve and become much more interesting in the future.
So on organizational level, you're arguing that there is a new form of political organizing, maybe even a new kind of political vocabulary that is being born in the midst of this conflict that could in the future be the basis for a more democratic, let's say, order in Syria. What can you say about the ideological program or direction of these local councils and the coordinating committees? Do they have a specific ideology, or is the conventional vocabulary of politics not even present in the way that they work?
So it's a politics of praxis, actually. They are learning as they are solving their problems. Many of them are traditional, they are conventional, but they are also inventing a new vocabulary, as you say. And I think it has the potential to evolve into a very interesting political organization that we haven't seen in other places. Maybe the closest example of that is what we've seen emerging in some Latin American cities and in India, for example, with participatory democracy at the level of the city and so on. So in many ways, they are really trying to solve the local problems. They are trying to solve the residents' and neighborhoods' problems and so on. So far, they haven't been involved in the big discussion of what type of Syria, what kind of constitution do we want, what is our role in the future, and so on. But I think that some of those debates and some of those questions are going to emerge quite soon. And this opposition has the potential to evolve into a much more interesting, much more democratic type of political organizing.
One final question. You've been thinking a lot about post-conflict Syria. It has to end someday. I'm wondering how you're thinking about that. First, in terms of time, what in your mind is the likely scenario for ratcheting down of this conflict and emergence of a new order? And two, what are the issues that people need to think about now in terms of that possible future?
Part of the opposition, the Free Syrian Army, is talking about the Battle of Damascus, which is, according to them, coming soon. And according to them, again, it's going to take only a few weeks. I'm very doubtful. I don't think this is a realistic scenario. I think that the regime is still very powerful in the cities, that the military is still very cohesive and powerful. And so I think the trick is going to be on changing the terms of the game by creating new alliances, by trying to attract some of the minorities, especially the Christian and Druze and the Alawite minorities. And the opposition have been failing in doing that so far. But this is, I think, the only way to end that war and have potentially a successful revolution.
Yes, sir, that does not seem like such a hopeful note to me, because the Gulf, as you say, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and others are funding part of the opposition precisely in order to marginalize or keep away from any future role the Alawites and other minorities. So if a strategy depends on creating alliances with these very groups, they have to be able to offer them something. Is this what explains what you keep referring to as the cohesiveness of the regime? They don't see a future for themselves in the opposition's imagination of a future Syria. Would you say that's true?
So more recently, the opposition, the National Coalition, offered to negotiate with the regime. I don't think that the regime is going to negotiate with the opposition. But part of the opposition, and this is unfortunately the marginal part, is trying hard to open up to the different sects, trying to have a more open political discourse and so on. But as long as there are so many players, and those players are obviously opposed to that type of scenarios and want a war of attrition to keep going, for example, the Gulf and the U.S. to a certain extent and so on. And Israel is not opposed to that as long as we don't have fragmentation and the regime is still powerful and so on. So that's going to be tricky. And I think the opposition has to play a more important role in trying to co-opt or trying to attract that that part of the Syrian population.
Thank you very much, Yasser. It was great having you on the program.
Thank you very much for having me.